This week on Potlatch, Ron Sanungatuk and Robert Wongatillen on Alaska Native Art.
Potlatch, a program about Alaska Natives for Alaska Natives.
We begin now with the part one of the interview with Ron Sanungatuk, the University of Alaska art professor, and Ron Wongatillen, University of Alaska art student, both Eskimos. Interviewing are Levi Lott and Ann Nicolai, and Ann Nicolai asked Sanungatuk how he got his start in artwork.
I was a young boy. I think I must have been about 14 years old when I became involved in some form of art, and that was ivory, mostly ivory carving, you know, where I grew up, Wales, up north at Seward Peninsula. We had kind of a thing going where if we were young kids, we were encouraged to do some ivory carving. And that's what I remember.
What materials do you carve from?
This word carving is not a real good term for description of activities I do in line of art. I may carve some wood. Once in a while, I'll carve a wood bowl, you know, out of, say, mahogany or rosewood. That's a carving in a right sense, but my main education in artwork later on turned out to be silversmithing. I'm a trained silversmith, so my work in silver now is mostly in jewelry, and that's jewelry crafts, not necessarily carving of a craft. It's not just carving.
I've heard that you've traveled quite a bit studying art. What are some of the places that you have traveled?
First it was Wales with ivory carving, and then I went to Mount Edgecombe School, where I studied under a man at that place. He was teacher at that time, and he really got me pretty well involved in working with ivory and wood together for bowls and things like that, you know. So it grew a little bit from small pieces of carvings to larger things. And then after Mount Edgecombe, I went to Rochester, New York, and I spent 4 years at Rochester studying at Rochester Institute of Technology, where I studied woodworking and silversmithing. And after Rochester, I went to Oslo, Norway. I had a Fulbright scholarship to go there, and I spent a year there studying at the National Arts and Crafts School of Norway. And I continued my studies in silversmithing and in design. While at Norway, I spent quite a bit of time in Sweden, Finland, and Denmark to become quite a bit aware of Scandinavian art, you know, crafts.
Could you explain what silversmithing is?
Silversmithing is a profession by itself. It's not very well known in the United States. Usually a silversmith, individual silversmith, is a craftsman. For example, a woodworker is a craftsman, potter is a craftsman, and silversmith is a craftsman. Silversmithing trains you to do design work for silver companies. You know, you can design coffee pots, for example, for International Silver or some group like that. And you can also, while you're a designer, you can also do jewelry work. That's what I do a lot right now, is doing an awful lot of jewelry. I apply this jewelry of mine to fit Alaska quite a bit. I use some ivory on it and some Alaskan materials together. I'm not trying to do really Alaskana, but it's why not, if I'm in Alaska, why not I use some of the Alaskan materials along with silver. Silver is my favorite material. Sometimes I use gold.
Do you think the artistic ability is inherited or learned? Another way of putting the question is, are Eskimo artists born or developed?
This is a rather debatable kind of question. I think not all Native people are artists. I think it's not valid to say that all Native people can be artists. I think, however, it's possible to say that Native people are adaptable to hand work because, of course, they have used their hands a lot, you know, taking care of outboard mortars and all the whole bit. So with this kind of background, you're apt to be able to use your hands much more, and your kind of life, your culture has been less industrialized kind of thing, and all these things put together makes it easier for you to do craft work. But it's not true that all Alaskan natives are potentially artists. I think an artist is happiest, to me anyway, if he is rather free. He doesn't have to stick to a particular line. Just because he is an Eskimo, I don't think he has to make all of his work Eskimo forever. If he wants to explore different possibilities, I think he should not be uptight about being Eskimo. I think that if he wants to be absolutely individual, I think his style should become that individual style, not because that he is Eskimo, you know. Sure, there is some nice thing about Eskimo art, for example. It can mean pretty good identity to you. Your work, when it relates to Eskimo style, gives you that sort of security. But sometimes for some artists, it becomes a crutch. They cannot get away from it. They cannot become maybe universal artist or great artist or something of that sort because they get stuck to it, you know. So myself, I'm going to treat myself as Ransanungitak, who wants to do his art. I'm not going to listen to too many people who are very often saying to me that I must confine my work to ivory because Eskimo people have traditionally been doing that kind of work. That I think that's a wrong attitude for people to tell me that I must keep my work to look always like ivory. I think I must be free to do whatever I want to, like other people.
With You, Honey, with Buffy St. Marie. With us on the Potlatch Network is KRXA in Seward, Alaska. Some people think that the Alaska Native land claim settlement has made Alaska Natives millionaires. But Alaska Natives know better. Land claims cash payments, in some instances, amount to small change. In very many instances, inflation has eaten up all benefits from land claims. If you find putting food on the table is getting harder to do each year, here's a tip from the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Service. You can stretch your food dollar by serving a little less meat and a little more peanut butter. Yes, peanut butter. 26% of peanut butter is protein, the protein you get from moose, caribou, or bear, or the meat you buy in the supermarket. In addition, peanut butter has some vitamins you need to keep up the active life you lead. A peanut butter sandwich today can cost you as little as 8 cents for the peanut butter, and here are some suggestions to vary your peanut butter sandwiches. Spread one slice of bread with peanut butter and the other with cream cheese. Or try peanut butter with raisin bread occasionally, if you can get raisin bread where you live. If you can get fresh lettuce, try varying it with lettuce. There's a suggestion from the Cooperative Extension Service of the University of Alaska. Their job is to serve you. But to serve you, they need to know what you want to know. So why not write them a letter? If you have suggestions to fight inflation, write them, Cooperative Extension Service, University of Alaska, or write us, KUAC, Fairbanks, Alaska. It's that simple. Now back to the interview with Ron Sanungatuk, Robert Wangatillan, Levi Lott, and Ann Nicolai.
What are Eskimo masks used for?
Well, maybe a question might be, what were Eskimo masks used for? They're not too prevalent today in Alaska. Some entertaining groups, entertainers for tourists, are using them today, so it's primarily for entertainment now. The dancers themselves, when they are dancing for themselves, generally do not use masks anymore. Maybe just one village or so will do that. But at that at the time they were used for ceremonies, invitational dances. You know, one village might invite another village and have a kind of an annual festival, and that was a production of the year. And so these masks were a variety of masks. Some were purely comical masks, and some were maybe more serious types, maybe related to kind of religion or to magic sort of thing, you know. Part of shamanism. And some masks were used for whale ceremonies after the successful whale hunt. The captain sometimes was using dance masks that were strictly for whale captain of a boat, for example, had a particular whaling mask. And then there was sometimes a simpler kind of mask that was used as a kind of a lid of a wood dish that was used also for some of the whaling activities.
Robert, what sort of art do you do?
Right now, I carve a lot to ivory, but I kind of really like silver. I mix silver with ivory, and maybe I might even try working with gold more often too, because I like kind of feel of gold too.
Yeah, I might add for Robert here. Robert was an ivory carver in kind of a hard line, traditionalist kind of line. When I first became actively involved with him, and what I mean by that is he became my student after a while. And before that, he was pretty much an ivory carver. And his work isn't drastically changed. I mean, his ivory carving is beautiful. But we said, let's try some silver, let's try some marble, and And so his work is enlarging somewhat from ivory to big piece of marble, you know, marble sculpture. And then his silver with ivory is kind of studying his own St. Lawrence Island style of a long time ago.
In general, is Eskimo art functional as well as decorative?
It was mostly functional a long time ago. And it has become much more purely decorative in commercialism, since the Western man came to the scene. It became a saleable product, and so it became not a part of a spear anymore. It became an ivory carving, which was to be taken back to Boston or someplace else, you know. So this period is primarily decorative, but as soon as the artist is capturing back the creativity for himself, he's going to do it mostly for not so much pure decorative. He'll do it for other things, art for art, you know.
Robert, what made you decide to come to University of Alaska?
Well, Melvin Olano was on the island. Kind of talked to me. I get kind of interested, so I pick up my name. I'm one of the guys. And that fall, we heard from Ron, and we come over here.
Ron, how would you tell somebody, younger people or even older people, that would like to take the course here? How would they go about doing it?
The way that it has been happening has been somewhat by reputation. The our present group goes home at the end of the school year. And then they tell their friends, or they tell their brothers and sisters, and say, there's a program there that maybe is okay for you. Why don't you write to Ron? This has been a pretty good way, except that it's slow way, you know. It's not, we're a small group, so if we're going to be a big group, we'd have to use some other method, like writing letters to superintendents of schools or something like that, you know. We're going to have a brochure organized so that we'll be able to tell various people in different places to so that hopefully they'll know about the program.
The brochure should be sent out to these regional corporations and these village corporations too.
Yeah, we're kind of searching a good way to set up a communication. We haven't it's almost like one-man operation in this program, where a person cannot do everything. So hopefully we should become better at communications, including getting involved, getting in touch with corporations. You know, that would be a good way.
Why does Eskimo art cost so much?
Well, I think that's almost like asking, why does Alyeska pipeline cost so much? This is a question can be apropos to one situation and not be good to another situation. For example, if there is a technique in market that is kind of a sly technique, then you'll often find real high markups on some things. They may not be very costly at the beginning, but they certainly are costly when you find them in Anchorage, for example. And that technique is a bum technique. Now, so that the cost is very, very high. For more individual art, I don't think there is any guideline to a pricing. I think my piece of work, for example, could cost $500, and it really isn't that high. It's just the buyer who doesn't know too much that, you know, sometimes general public is not terribly aware, and also they're getting mixed up with trinket market compared to fine art market. Trinket market is, you might get a copy of native art, say from Taiwan or Japan. It comes and lands in in Alaska, and that little ivory seal is a copy of an Alaskan-made seal, but that little seal is only $1, and the Alaskan-made one is $5. So people are going, they don't know the difference, but they're going to ask, how come it's so expensive? You know, there are so many of these
it's
variations.
Synthetic made.
Yeah.
Robert, how old were you when you first started carving?
Well, about 16 or 17, maybe, somewhere there. I mostly learned from my father. Give me a tip or like that. In fact, my first sail was looked like either bird or sail. I wouldn't.
Does the money a person pays for an Eskimo work of art go to the creator or the dealer?
Some of it goes to the trader or the dealer.
And does the Eskimo artist get a fair share of the price?
Not always. This is a very difficult situation because in the past for a long, long time, to me anyhow, it has been a retailing market or the middleman market that has been a controlling factor in this whole business. The, for example, we could talk about a guy who lives in Anchorage, say, or Fairbanks, and he goes up to St. Lawrence Island to go buy a whole suitcase full of ivory products, and he comes back to the big city, and then he wheels and deals at the gift shops, you know. That traveling salesman and the gift shop activity virtually controls the market. Now, if we're going to do it more like a right way, the native people themselves, who are artists and craftsmen, would have to be the controlling entity. They would set the prices and ensure that there is the demand is met and all these things. They'd become, say, like guild, art guild, and that's when I think there would be much more equal kind of situation. I think a craftsman in Alaska cannot make a really good living out of ivory carving now, because they just don't get the proper markup, you know, their share. It's a kind of a traditional line that a native person is going to play second fiddle to another guy who is a first fiddle, you know, who's the controlling. We got to turn it around.
I think that word guild would be, I don't think some people would know it, you know. It would be like forming a corporation, you know.
Yeah, there would have to be tremendous educational activity. Look at the whole Western Alaska. It would have to be, you'd have to feel like you're part of the system, that this is a thing that works for you, that it's not working for the government and for, you know, for the good of the government, but it's working for good of you, you know, for you. So the thing I'm talking about is a little bit out in the future, but I think the corporation, the movement in Alaska, Alaska Native political movement and so on, will make it much easier sometimes in the future to begin to look into this activity, you know.
Is there an economic future for an Eskimo artist?
I think so, but it's not going to be a wide-scale kind of success. I think it has to be again, the individuals who become, who recognize themselves as artists and bona fide craftsmen, that they're going to do it for real, that they're not going to do it on part-time basis, you know, do it on business or a basis which makes the ends meet, you know, decent food, decent housing, and so on. When that kind of feeling comes about, then I think there will be, there is so much demand for real good work that we're not able to, you know, if a person just have enough education and artistic ability, yes, and also, but more rounded education, gosh, it could be, I think, would be marvelous future.
Most often when we think of Eskimo art, we think of Eskimo sculpture and Eskimo music. What about Eskimo painting and pottery? Are they as important?
Not in a traditional sense. The pottery hasn't been terribly important. There's an activity in Bethel area, but it's trying to, just trying to be born. It isn't ongoing yet. What was the painting? Painting was the other. I think it would be more like printmaking, graphic kind of art, you know, rather than so much oil painting. Oil painting will be some individuals, but it wouldn't be large scale all across the board activity. It would be printmaking that would have more regional appeal, and it could catch on more among the villages and so on. I think, sure, there's awful lot of ivory carving. It could widen into other areas of crafts. I think printmaking is a good possibility, and individuals in painting or whatever who are going to be teachers. You know, for example, Robert here, he could be specialist. A new kind of specialty will be teaching for him.
In closing, do you have any kind of remark that you'd like to make to the listeners that you feel is important?
We must, I hope myself that I can be very independent. If I'm not independent, I am a puppet to some people or to institute or to some organizations. I don't want to be a puppet. I want to be a very free man doing my artwork, and that includes people, I hope, not having to tell me that I must confine my work to looking like an ethnic work. I would like to reserve that right, and I hope that other people will too. You know, there's too much expectation in the state that we must preserve so that Alaskan art will always be Alaskan art. I think any art must be, if it's going to be living art, has to be creative, changing, change from era to era, and never be the same. I mean, there will be you still will recognize it as a group's work or work of a particular race, yes, but I'm trying to say that it must not be traditionalized or coming to a one segment which makes it impossible to go into forever experimenting and different changes and so on. You know, this kind of I'd like to devote my life into that.
Potlatch, produced in the studios of KUAC in College in cooperation with KTOO Juneau, KOTC Kotzebue, and KYUK Bethel, under Title I of the Higher Education Act.